Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
It's nice to be here this morning with all of you, and I know a couple of you were here all night sitting as well. I can kind of feel the energy from the... Seriously, yeah, you can feel it when people have been in a room concentrating in that way. It really resonates. So some of you may not know that this is... the day that is the last day of the final intensive retreat of the year. All over the world in Zen communities, they've been sitting for 7 days, and often through the night of the seventh day into the morning of the eighth day. And what is happening for that is replicating the Buddha's last week, where he said, I'm not going to get up from under this tree until I have an understanding, I'm enlightened. And with the rising of the morning star on the eighth morning, he had an incomplete understanding of the way things really are. And so we try to replicate that through this intensive retreat. And it's an experience that everybody should have at least once, I really believe. If you've never done an intensive retreat like that, it's worth it. Most of us are so stubborn, we could use many, many of them in our lifetimes to break through the kind of crust that we develop as human beings. So I wanted to speak a little bit about this issue of enlightenment, not in the way that we normally speak about it, but in the Zen tradition we often... say, once we have wisdom, compassion is going to arise naturally. And that's possibly so. For some of us, that may be a long wait, you know, if that's in fact what it is. My own personal sense is that it's not really a chicken and egg sort of thing, you know, that we have to be wise before you can be compassionate. They're very much tied together, but when we use the terms wisdom and compassion, it creates a separation between the two that doesn't really exist. And so there's a way in which we kind of work on them together. And enlightenment we might think of as the ultimate wisdom experience, but I wanted to talk about that experience in terms of compassion for a bit, and particularly self-compassion. Why do we start with compassion for ourselves? And when I say self-compassion, I'm not talking about self-care or its crazy cousin, self-indulgence. These are very different things. Self-compassion is about understanding our suffering, accepting our suffering, and trying to alleviate our own suffering. Now, again, suffering doesn't mean my knees hurt necessarily. I mean, that may feel like suffering to us, but that's not the type of suffering that we're talking about. And why do we have to start with ourselves? It might seem like it would be easier to start having compassion for other people, and then when we kind of got it jump-started, we can then apply that to ourselves. But we always start with applying compassion to ourselves for a couple of reasons. First, if we try to generate self-compassion by doing compassionate acts for others, we may just be building up a stronger sense of our ego. You know, look, from a superiority point of view, we might be thinking, oh, look how compassionate I am, look how generous I am. Or it might be from a sense of inferiority, as if I don't do this, I'm not worthy of self-compassion. And that I think we kind of toggle between the two. If we emphasize compassion towards others before we really work on it towards ourselves. So that's one reason that we need to start with self-compassion. But secondly, if we don't understand our own suffering, we're never really going to get what it is that causes other people to suffer. We may be looking at kind of the external aspect of suffering rather than what is deep inside. And the reality is that we are all worthy of being loved, regardless of our accomplishments and regardless of how the world sees us. If it still feels impossible to start with yourself, you can begin by including yourself with all other beings. For example, you can say, all of us want to be happy. All of us feel vulnerable at times. And that includes me. You know, I'm not different from other people in that way. And perhaps we can generate some warmth towards ourselves in that way. But it's if we don't, we still run the risk of trying to look compassionate and doing compassion in a kind of a transactional way. So how do we actually achieve or work at self-compassion? It begins with self-examination, self-reflection, to begin to recognize the aspects of ourselves that we're really not that fond of, that we don't like, and practice opening to those, to hold them and really accept their reality. Now, some aspects of ourselves we're really able to do that with, because we get a lot of feedback on it. And, you know, it's like I know I can be kind of bossy. Ask my kids. Ask my husband. I know that about myself because I get a lot of feedback in that way. And I recognize it, and that's okay. But that's not all of what's going on. There are other ways in which I know that I'm suffering, and they don't necessarily come out in ways that people can see them clearly and give me feedback. And I don't see them because it's kind of like looking at the nose on your face. It can be very difficult, very painful work to do, and it actually may seem to increase our sense of suffering rather than alleviate it. So there's no wonder we try to avoid doing this kind of work with ourselves. So sometimes when we're sitting, particularly for a long period of time, our defenses kind of will let down because we're tired, we're hurting, we're anxious, we're irritated. All that stuff can allow things to bubble up that we didn't necessarily notice before. When we're not doing anything else but sitting, that can happen. But that can also be kind of a random process. There may be things that are really hard for us, that are very defended in us, that we can't bring up so easily. Or if they come up, we push them away. That's an intrusive thought. Don't need that thought. Push it away. And we don't do the work of reflecting on what's happening. So one of the things that can help us is to have a mirror for that. So there's the feedback that comes when your behavior gets in people's way. And if you really look at that honestly, you can say, okay, here's what's going on. You know, sure, I know what I'm doing. You know, I know better than everybody else what I'm doing. But also, there's probably a way that I can be in the world that's a little less obnoxious. So there's that kind of mirror, the feedback that we get. But one of the things that really helps is to work with a teacher, if you can work with a teacher who can kind of guide you along the path. And a teacher doesn't necessarily have to be in a formal teacher-student relationship, but somebody who you can see is kind of doing okay on the path. They seem to be able to get around obstacles and all, and you can work with them and reflect with them. Or peers. I have a group of women that I sit with every month. We call ourselves the Buddha Buddies, and we meet every month and talk about practice and how it's unfolding in our life and obstacles that we've had, and you know, this has come up for me, and we give each other feedback in that way. And it's been a marvelous thing. So that kind of Dharma friend that you can trust is another way to work. But we're not limited to those kinds of things. Pretty much anything can be our teacher in this way, can provide that mirror for us. One of the biggest revelations to me doing this kind of work was that the people who annoy me the most are often reflecting back something that I'm uncomfortable about in myself. And that was a huge revelation to me. It's like, why did they do that? Oh. You know, and then that's something to chew on for a while when you see that. So that kind of annoyance or reactivity that we may have to somebody, I don't know what it is, but I just don't like them. You know, that's a really rich area to explore. Those people can be a huge help to us in this work. And an extreme example, you know, I was realizing, why do we find Donald Trump so difficult to stomach? It's really hard for most of us. Even the people who may support some of the things he's doing, I think, are beginning to go, something a little off, you know. We tend to focus on his behavior, right? Which is appalling in many ways, for sure. But underlying it all, I think it's very, very clear that he has an extremely defended sense of ego. Everything he does is for self-preservation. Everything. And he's like the poster child for self-absorption. And that's really a benefit to us, because if you look at his face, if you really look at his face or read his tweets, with that in mind, you can begin to see the terrible pain that he must be feeling all the time. And there's literally fear oozing from him. You can feel it. It's painful for us to watch because it holds up a mirror to our own ego clinging. I really believe that this is part of why we find him so difficult. It's like, this is what happens if you don't deal with this. You become like this. And that's not something that we want to contemplate. We can feel compassion for the pain that drives his behavior. We can feel compassion for the pain that drives his behavior. And acknowledge as well that when we act in that way, clinging to our ego, doing things out of a sense of self-preservation, we could cause harm too, right? The point here is we're not condoning his behavior, right? This is a process of identifying, bearing witness to, and holding this understanding of him and ourselves without judgment. That's self-compassion, when we can feel the pain we cause others and ourselves through our ego clinging. When we really open to that, we can feel compassion for ourselves, that we are causing suffering in ourselves and others, and we want to alleviate that suffering. There's a lovely poem that came through in the Daily Dharma that comes from Tricycle Magazine the other day, and I feel like it really expresses what self-compassion can look like. The poem is Mercy by Mark Hart. My throat is a clenched fire, an arson's match. All day long I have watched a huge porcupine like a pile of coal or a burnt stump, move about the yard in the cold rain eating apples, satisfying the soft, needy underside she protects. And I think I know what it is to cause anguish to those who touch you, to forage alone, and to crave sweet mouthfuls of mercy. That is what we're talking about. It's not easy, but it's honest. It lightens our burden to do this work, to really acknowledge what's going on. And the alchemy that goes on when we're able to feel compassion for ourselves allows us to ease up on our identification of ourself with certain habitual behaviors we have, certain traits we have, certain attitudes we have, ways of being. If we can feel compassion towards ourselves, we begin to see that this package of traits does not define or confine us, that we can peel them away one by one and begin to understand and experience our life as an ever-changing river rather than a solid rock. Right? It's much easier, and from that place of lightness and ease and spaciousness, we can begin to open more to other people. So when we're less defended, we can begin to see in other people their own vulnerability, their own lack of understanding of how things are, that they don't have to be so defended. It doesn't mean that we can sit back and be warm and fuzzy at all. You know, compassion doesn't mean, oh, you know, I'm not going to do or say anything to that person to upset them. That's not what compassion is. We need to set boundaries and sometimes act forcefully and decisively. But it comes from a sense of shared suffering as fellow sentient beings, rather than a feeling of superiority. Oh, that poor being, I need to help them, right? This is what we're doing. It's not as dismal as it might sound, though. I mean, really, they've done research that shows that when you're feeling this true compassion, actually, not just the sense in your brain that understands suffering lights up, but actually the pleasure center lights up, because we can acknowledge this connection that we have. And so when we loosen up in this way and become more at ease, we can begin to operate beyond that constant state of separation that we feel. And it's often described as the three spheres. This is a phrase that's used often in Tibetan Buddhism, of subject, object, and activity. So some of you that were here this morning and sat all night shared a bowl of tea, which is a wonderful practice, this Japanese tea ceremony. And when we practice tea, what we're doing is not practicing to look good at doing tea, but we're practicing so that host and guest and the activity of sharing tea become one, and that there's not a sense of separation, and that we don't judge, oh, you know, the host's doing a pretty good job, but this guest doesn't know what they're doing, or that's a terrible bowl of tea. Or, you know, we don't have any kind of assessment like that, but there's that shared experience, and that's the most important aspect. The other day I was at the prison with one group of inmates, and one of the inmates shared that he often gets depressed around the holidays, as many people do, for a lot of reasons, but he said being away from family and unable to really celebrate in the way that he wanted to made him very depressed, and he used to just go into his cell and stay in his bed all day, and that was it. So he knew he was depressed, and that was his response, but he discovered something. He said he learned that if he starts feeling that way, if he goes out of his cell and talks to people, other people, about anything, any people out there, and just engages them in conversation, that helps to feel that connection to other beings. And the profound insight that he had was, he said, you know, the conversation can go very poorly here in prison. Particularly, he's in the psych ward. It's, you know, it's it's kind of intense there. And conversation may not go how you intended it to. So he said, it doesn't really matter if I make a good or a bad connection with that person. He said, it's the connection that counts. It's far more important than whether it was a good or a bad connection. I thought that's a really deep insight into what this means to transcend the three spheres of subject, object, and activity, but simply to acknowledge this fact of connection. So how does enlightenment relate to this? The term enlightenment is often used to kind of underscore the aspect of shining a light of clarity on how things really are, but I also like that it resonates with lightening our load, lightening our burden, our overactive ego. In other words, we're lightening up on that ego-centric way of being. Enlightenment is the opposite of an ego trip in this sense. So whatever practice path we take, we're at risk of strengthening rather than loosening the grip of ego in our sense of self when we apply a sense of striving to it. You know, that person really looks good. I'm going to sit up. I'm going to look just as good as they are. Doesn't matter, you know. If we get kind of focused or fixated on that sort of thing, that sort of external way of judging, that's a way to reinforce our sense of self, our sense of this ego. It becomes a kind of Zen Olympics if we're not careful. You know, we're in competition with each other to be the best Zen student. And the effort that we apply in retreats or in our practice in any way isn't about pushing as much as it's about staying the course, about being able to stay and bear witness to the unpleasantness of seeing our own ego trip. And through seeing that, we can begin to lighten up on it. We can begin to let it go. We can begin to see, this is not who I am. This is not what defines me. I don't have to be this way. So really one of the tests for me about this is when we begin to feel joy rather than pride as we progress along the path. Pride indicates our ego is still engaged. But if we can feel joy in this, that's what is really going to help. So I would say as we head into this holiday season in earnest, let's be thankful for all the many mirrors that appear for us. Take advantage of those to help us see and appreciate ourselves more clearly, for the opportunity to practice, for the opportunity to make connections, whether so-called good or so-called bad. And let's all continue on this path together in our efforts to lighten up.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.